BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Just to let you know that this episode of Antisocial contains some strong discriminatory language. Hello, I'm Adam Fleming, and this is the Antisocial podcast from BBC Radio 4. Each episode, we take one subject that's big online and look at it from a load of different angles, like a dating app, but we'll match you with facts and nuanced arguments. This week, a committee of MPs is investigating the effect of climate change on ethnic minorities. They receive a submission from an umbrella group representing organisations with an interest in the countryside. It alleges that rural areas in Britain are racist and colonialist. At least that's how some newspapers reported it, after they'd stripped out quite a lot of the other words. New fuel for a question that's been burning for a while. Is the countryside racist?
In these spaces that are particularly dominated by white people, it can feel quite exclusive.
I mean, all anyone has to do to access the countryside is get in their car, then start walking.
I became incredibly aware of the fact that I was mixed race because I was no longer surrounded by people who looked like me.
What a load of old rubbish. They're literally now going out deliberately looking for things to get annoyed about.
Who said what to which committee when? We'll try and find out what really happened. There's data on who lives in the countryside, but it doesn't tell the whole story. We'll crunch it as best we can. And a cultural institution was dragged into this culture war because it changed its descriptions of some famous paintings. What is in a label? And if you want to get involved in the discussion online, you can use the hashtag BBCAntisocial. And with me throughout this episode of Antisocial are two people who come at this discussion from different perspectives. Here in the studio is Beth Collier, director of Wild in the City. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Adam. How are you?
Very well, thank you. What does Wild in the City do?
Wild in the City supports people of colour in nurturing their relationship with nature and the natural world and finding our place in the British countryside. And we do that through programmes in natural history, hiking and ecotherapy.
And why did you set up Wild in the City?
I grew up in the countryside, so I've got an unusual experience as a person of colour of the nature and the natural world being very normal to my childhood experiences. And when I moved into the city, realised that wasn't the case for many people of colour growing up in cities. So it was about helping people feel safe to explore, gain knowledge and insight, and to be able to enjoy remote wild spaces.
And also, it's your job as well. This isn't sort of a hobby.
No. Yes. Yeah. By background, I'm a nature allied psychotherapist. So in addition to exploring our human social relationships, there's an opportunity to explore our relationship with the natural world.
Okay. Right. And on the line is Dominic Whiteman, editor of Country Squire magazine. Hi, Dominic.
Good afternoon, Adam.
So just explain to us what Country Squire magazine is.
So Country Squire magazine is an online and offline magazine which was founded in 2016. It's based in the actual countryside, so it's unlike most country magazines which kind of coo at the rural idyll from their city offices. We have around 90,000 subscribers, so think kind of Land Rovers, Barber Brigade types, and also impoverished rural working class gamekeepers, gillies, farm workers. Yep.
I'm listening between the lines of what you said. You thought there was a sort of gap in the market for coverage.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're what you call a vertical magazine. So we're, we have gamekeepers writing articles, put it that way. We actually go out to the countryside, which is where I'm based. I'm based just off Dartmoor in Devon. And we have people in the countryside actually write the articles and get involved in the interviews.
And Dominic, what was your, not to get all your previous addresses, but like, what's your history? Were you living in the city once?
Absolutely, yes. So I spent 10 years not leaving, West One, so a couple of streets away from where you are right now.
Oh, central London.
And then when I had kids, I moved out into Devon in the southwest. But I've got quite a bit of experience as well of North Yorkshire, so I'd consider myself now a countryman. I've been down in the countryside for the last 15, 16 years.
Right. Now, before we dive into this week's discussion, let's get to the bottom, or try to get to the bottom, of what started this all off. Producer Ellie House has been following that thread. Hello, Ellie.
Hi, Adam. So, yes, this conversation about rural racism is something that's been bubbling along for a while. But it made it to the top of talk show agendas earlier this year because of an inquiry by the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Race and Justice.
Oh, yes. And as a former political reporter, these APPGs are groups of MPs who have a common interest in a subject. They're quite different from the select committees, which kind of shadow government departments and have statutory powers.
Yes. And this group is looking at the links between racism, colonialism and global warming. So quite a thorny topic here.
And so this group of MPs put out a call for evidence on those issues. What did they get back?
They got lots of different responses, including one from something called the Wildlife and Countryside Link. So that's an umbrella organisation which represents 83 nature and environment groups, so charities, NGOs and the like. But it's important to say that not all of them supported the response from the Wildlife and Countryside Link.
So this was a response from an umbrella organisation rather than the organisations that are its members?
Yes, only 11 of the 83 member groups signed it. So Wildlife and Countryside Link wrote things like, quote, "Racist colonial legacies continue to frame nature in the UK as a white space and people of colour as out of place in these spaces and the environmental sector." And this caused quite a backlash.
It's quite an absurd thing to claim. There is no barrier to anyone enjoying the countryside other than your ability to get there. And that's got nothing to do with colour.
So there was so much of a backlash that Wildlife and Countryside Link then had to come out with a statement saying that they had been misrepresented.
How so?
So they said they don't think that the entire countryside is a racist, colonial, white space, but there are still challenges around access to green space for certain people. And they backed that up with evidence from government bodies.
And what evidence was that?
The Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs wrote in a 2019 report that, quote, "The countryside is seen by both black, Asian and minority ethnic groups and white people as very much a white environment." And that's based on around 2,500 submissions and direct engagement with people and organisations in the countryside.
And was there anything else?
Yes, they also quoted a 2022 report from the organisation Natural England, which concluded that, quote, "People from ethnic minority backgrounds can feel or be made to feel out of place in natural environments where visitors or residents are predominantly white." And some of this is based on research by Leicester University.
Oh, so we have surveys from the government and studies by academics.
Yes, and both have provoked quite a reaction. And Leicester University is now involved in a 2-year project looking at rural racism, including researchers from its Centre for Hate Studies. That prompted some tweets like this one. "The hate finders are coming. Hate experts are planning to descend on the English countryside to hunt for a type of hate they're calling rural racism."
So in other words, the tweeters didn't like the idea that people who specialise in studying hate are doing this research into the countryside.
Exactly. But this project is still in its early stages, so we won't know all of their findings until next year. What we do know is that it's based on conversations with people from all ethnic backgrounds about living in, working and visiting the English countryside.
So that's qualitative research rather than quantitative. It's people's stories, not necessarily numbers.
Yes. And this brings us to the very latest thing to make headlines. An article a couple of weeks ago by John Craven of BBC Countryfile fame. Now, he has spoken to one of the Leicester team and he got a sneak peek at some of their research.
And what did he glean?
So things like the stories of two minority women living in rural areas who were both subjected to racist taunts, in one instance spat on and in another threatened with weapons. The researcher also said that there are what they described as subtler moments of unconscious racism. And all of this, the researcher told John Craven, is in addition to moments of generosity and warmth from the locals.
OK, and with all these studies going on, has anything been done to try and make people from ethnic minorities feel more welcome in the countryside?
Yes. So we've got a few examples. In the Peak District, there are now signs pointing out the direction of Mecca in several places, which can be useful for Muslims when it comes to prayer time. And Muslim hikers can now also buy waterproof outdoor prayer mats as well. Elsewhere, there's an outdoor activity centre where instructors speak Urdu and Pashto, and there's halal food on the menu. And there are also some specific groups, such as Black Girls Hike, Muslim Hikers, the Black Cycling Network.
And Beth's own group, Wild in the City. Beth, what do you make of this thread of research and surveys that caused such a backlash?
It correlates with our own research, which has been very influential in the environmental field from 2016 to 2019, we conducted in-depth ethnographic research looking at people of colour's relationship with nature in the UK and attitudes and feelings to being in the countryside, which very much echo some of the later findings. And as a result of our research, we published an article in The Ecologist called Black Absence in Green Spaces, explaining a sort of historical to contemporary understanding of why people of colour feel that they're not welcome. And that is a journey from historical messages from colonialism and slavery that we're somehow backward or primitive for being close to nature. And so there's a desire to demonstrate that we're now progressive and separate from nature, to our different experiences of migration and gathering for a sense of community and safety in numbers, which were in urban areas, to be able to establish ourselves for work and education, and experiencing extreme hostility, the colour bar and getting access to work in you know, access to public facilities. And it engendered an attitude in our elders that going into more remote areas wouldn't be safe because of the hostility experienced when you're collectively living together in cities.
So just to explain that last point.
If you encounter racism, where there are large numbers of people of colour, that's intimidating. But the idea that if you then ventured into areas where there are far fewer people of colour, that would be seen as more threatening. So there's a sense of keeping people safe with the idea of it's not for us, don't go. And that's parallel to receiving messages from white people that we don't belong, that we don't fit in. So that there are sort of different streams that come together that make people feel this isn't a space for us.
Yeah, there are a lot of big factors to untangle there. Dominic, do you want to just pick one of those factors and respond to it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the issues that people of colour have from coming over to the UK and the traditions and so forth that they've lost, maybe by not having the communication with elders. I understand that they're not able to go into the countryside, but my perspective and widespread experience in the countryside is that you know, John Craven's note about people being spat on and you know, attacked with weapons is very rare. You know, the British countryside is not systemically racist, and that to say so is an anti-truth. In other words, that those saying that countryside is a racist have an axe to grind, an ulterior motive for saying so. I'd also say that racism is racism no matter who it's directed towards. And it doesn't only affect people of colour. Anyone who's white is privileged, we're told, and racism only affects people of colour. That's wrong. The statistics show that there's a much higher chance of racism towards you know, Roma gypsies and traveller communities in the countryside. After that, I think it's Black Caribbean in the country as a whole. And after that, it's White Irish. So I think, you know, generalisations are polarising. I think this conversation needs nuance, yeah?
Well, that's why the programme Antisocial exists, to provide the nuance. Beth, do you want to react to that?
I'd agree that there are lots of people seen outside of the bracket of whites, and particularly white middle class, that experience racism and discrimination. So I wouldn't disagree with Dominic there that it's we work with people of colour, so that's who I'm speaking about. But yes, also people of different white backgrounds that aren't considered to be the typical white middle class, who are perceived as sort of culturally dominating the countryside.
Dominic used the phrase structural racism, something that comes up a lot in these conversations. Beth, are you saying that the countryside is structurally racist?
I'm saying there is a lot of racism in the countryside, although acknowledging, yes, obviously there's a whole range. You are going to meet warmth and friendship and welcome. But when you look at the institutions of the countryside, yes, there is systemic racism. For example, I would widen out the countryside to include the environmental sector, to involve the recreational organisations. And it can be very difficult for people of colour to feel welcome within them, or like ourselves, if you're a black-led organisation, to find your foothold and to have space in that sector.
OK, so when you talk about the institutions of the countryside, I can see why you might think, oh, like a charity representing the countryside, I can see that you could describe that as an institution. What are other institutions of the countryside?
So, for example, to get funding to be able to operate, the environmental sector for several years now, I said, where are the people of colour? Why don't we have leaders of colour? Why don't we have participants of colour? And it's like, we're here, but we can't get the funding to access, but also to have the voice to take part in debates and discussion. So it becomes systemic, it becomes existential, that it's very hard to operate in the space. We're also here trying to create opportunities for people, but it's very difficult for us to put across our narrative or to initiate the schemes we might have to make people feel safe and be encouraged to be in nature.
Dominic, when you hear anecdotes about people of colour suffering abuse, I mean, what do you think is going on there? Is that just one-offs? I mean, because the stories seem to be real and genuine.
I'm sure there are real and genuine stories. I mean, before coming on this programme, I spoke to some police and looked into, you know, the rural crime stats on hate crime. And this is very, you know, few and far between in terms of cases. I agree completely with what Beth's saying in terms of the NGOs and the big organisations who do keep some of these stats and were also signatories to that particular report. But actually, if we're looking for sort of bridge building and empathy here, I'd say, you know, if ethnic minorities are feeling oppressed and marginalised, they ought to feel a great deal of empathy with the downtrodden population of the UK countryside. You know, as people who've watched Clarkson's Farm will recognise, it's not easy to make a living from the land. And frankly, most of these big organisations and NGOs are urban. They have an urban viewpoint. So they're a hindrance to rural people and people of colour.
Let's not get too hung up on the idea of organisations and who's on the boards and who's the CEOs of charities and who funds them and the criteria for funding. But Beth, what about that idea that actually people in the countryside are pretty oppressed sometimes too? Like, yeah, rural poverty is a big
absolutely.
Thing?
Absolutely. I grew up in the countryside. You know, I'm aware of those issues, and I think it's interesting to see that through the lens of empire and colonialism also. Who's the landowner? Who are the gatekeepers? Who get access to the resources and to the management of nature and the natural world, and who are on the margins? And yes, white working class were disadvantaged in different ways to people of colour, but affected by generally the same class of person who had ownership, who was the gatekeeper.
Oh, so is it then about class and wealth rather than skin colour?
It's part of it, but not all of it. The issue is skin colour is you're visibly perceived as different and responded to as different, where there are other people who are white who might be disadvantaged, but it's not until you open your mouth or you demonstrate something that indicates that you're not the white middle class.
I mean, Dominic, as a white, and I'm assuming middle class person, or maybe upper class or working class, who knows, do you feel that you're kind of entitled to be in this conversation, or do you feel a bit excluded from it, or maybe a little bit kind of defensive potentially?
No, I don't feel defensive, because I feel that as a editor of Countryside magazine for the last 8 years or so, I've been able to go around and meet various countrysiders, and I'd say I'm white middle class, sure, but I wouldn't say that white privilege is blanket across the countryside at all. There's a lot of poverty. I train a rugby team, and the rugby team's got some kids who, you know, as soon as they come out of school, they're busy doing lambing until 3 a.m, and you know, they hardly have a change of clothes. They haven't got the money. There's no public transport and so forth. As Beth pointed out, it can be quite tough in the countryside. Look, I mean, I think the reality here is that there are racists in the countryside, just as there are in the towns, in the cities, in the Met. And unfortunately, that's just the nature of, you know, the country. The fact that there's, you know, 90% of people in the countryside are white is just how it is. And it's a white country in terms of the countryside. And that may be, you know, it's easy to get fearful of that. But I mean, I travel to Kumasi in Ghana, and when I get off the plane in Accra to you know, go out into the town, everyone's black. I don't have the fear.
Yeah, but that's you. That's you as a tourist visiting. That's not
business,
your life.
But, no, admittedly, but I don't expect people to change for me. I can see that, you know, rural areas in the UK, it's another country, rural life's the supply side of the economic process. It's where, you know, we take resources into human control. They've got food, forestry, mining, and so forth. It's the blood and guts and mud. And people who you might come across if you're visiting from the town and the city, they're at work. You know, a lot of rural land's farmland. It's someone's home and workshop. And there are things like countryside etiquette. You've got to be really careful about closing gates and things. And farmers do get angry if visitors behave badly, you know, just as you'd behave angrily if someone barged into your home in London and broke all the pencils on your townhouse desk or left a McDonald's burger wrapper on the floor that your poodle choked on, you know? The rural people have a rural culture. And it's quite easy to...
So basically, Dominic, anyone going to the countryside should just expect to get some grief because that's just what the countryside is like.
Not always. I mean, the farmers might be in a good mood, the foresters, or, you know, you might not have parked in front of their gate.
So it's just down to the luck of whether you encounter like a grumpy person or not.
Well, absolutely, yeah. But rural people tend to be at work. You know, they have different priorities, and that's not an excuse for racism, but they're, you know, they may be seen as gruff and grumpy because they're getting on with their lives, you know?
Beth?
Yeah, there's quite a few issues there I'd like to pick up on, sort of the sense that's just the way it is, the countryside is white. And, you know, you shouldn't expect people to change. I think the change being asked for is to just consider how your behaviour might be impacting on how welcome people feel based on colour. But also that sense of it's just the way it is. One of the overwhelming desires that our members express is they would love to live in the countryside. In our countries of heritage, we're often deeply connected to nature and the natural world, often living in rural areas. The difference that happens when we come to the UK is the experience of or fear of hostility. That's the difference. So a lot of people that we work with would love to live in the countryside, but don't feel safe to. And it's that word safety that's a big difference to a lot of white people who don't necessarily fear their personal safety or fear how am I going to be received to the extent it makes them feel anxious.
Okay, well, you know what? Let's try and get some facts and figures because we've sort of started to nudge into that territory. What does the countryside look like in terms of who lives there and their ethnic background, and how white is it or isn't it? Ruth McAreevy is Professor of Sociology at Newcastle University, and she's got an interest in rural development and rural migration.
The UK is very split. The rural population is very white. Approximately 97% of people living in rural England are white, as compared with the urban population, where it's closer to 80%.
How do we know that?
So we know that from Office of National Statistics, figures that are taken from the census, and then there are other proxies that are used to measure diversity in the countryside, so labour market statistics, health indicators, and so sort of people accessing health services has been used as a proxy.
And how do we in the UK define what a rural area actually is?
Rural areas in England are places with fewer than 10,000 inhabitants. Scottish definitions are sort of more around access to services. But in England, it's really places with fewer than 10,000 inhabitants.
And I suppose we shouldn't let those sort of different ways of measuring and those different data sets obscure the fact that basically the countryside, however you define it, is overwhelmingly populated by white people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very, very white space. Very homogenous, and it's very visible if you go into the countryside how white it is compared to if you're in, for example, the west end of Newcastle or the centre of London.
Do we know what ethnicities make up the non-white populations where they exist?
The non-white populations, we can delve into different local government figures and we can see the different ethnicities in different places. That is one aspect that sort of indicates ethnic diversity. But I think it's also important to bear in mind the white population that is non-British, so people who have been born outside of the UK. And that's particularly relevant in some rural areas where there is an overrepresentation of people from Eastern Europe working in the agri-food sector, working in horticulture and basically supporting food production in the UK.
So just give me an example of how that looks in certain places.
So I've done quite a lot of work with migrants who work in meat processing in Northern Ireland, and you can see areas around County Armagh, outside of Dungannon, where there are high levels of economic migrants working there. There are also a lot of economic migrants working in Lincolnshire, sort of around the Boston area in the east of England. They're supporting horticulture production. The other thing, Adam, to think about is the seasonality and temporality aspect. So we have a seasonal worker scheme, and at the moment, I think it's about 45,000 visas are allowed per year for workers to come over and support the industry. And they are coming from Central Asia mainly. So that is very visible in terms of how those individuals look in the countryside. But many of them live in tied accommodation. So although they may look different to the white population, they may not actually be participating in rural life because they are spending so much time working, picking vegetables and saving money so that they can spend that in their countries when they go back home. So it's quite a complex picture.
But if we zoom back out then from those particular examples and look at the whole country, is the ethnic minority groups that you see in the countryside, are they kind of the same as the makeup of ethnic groups across the whole UK? And I'm thinking that actually the biggest group is Asian people.
Yeah, I mean, it is very much very similar, and it is the biggest group is Asian people.
And is there a way of capturing data about how people feel about the rural area that they live in?
Yeah, I mean, there are surveys conducted, DEFRA do this, DERA in Northern Ireland, about satisfaction and quality of life. And I think it's interesting that in rural England, in rural Northern Ireland, residents report a higher quality of life pretty much consistently. Rural residents in England are much older than urban residents. Many people retire to rural England, and then you can imagine they have time on their hands, so there are higher rates of volunteering in rural areas. I also think people move often to this imagined countryside. So there's a very strong imaginary of what rural England is. And that gives people a strong sense of belonging.
Thank you to Ruth McAreevy. Dominic, what do you make about some of those figures that Ruth was giving us there?
Yeah, they don't surprise me at all. Where we're based in Dartmoor, there are one or two people of colour, knocking around the villages, but not many. But I would say that's increasing as the population's getting older. I've noticed that a lot more care workers coming into the rural towns, and they tend to be Asian Black Caribbean, particularly, and Filipino as well, coming into the hospitals.
And is that a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, everyone gets on perfectly well with them, as far as I can see. This idea of individual racists existing is across the country. There are unfortunately some numbskulls out there, and the old Ethiopian saying goes, no matter how many times you wash a goat, it'll still smell like a goat. There are some people that you just can't change, lost causes. But generally speaking, these people fit in brilliantly. And we live with a Gurkha lady, and she's never had any experiences of racism. My wife's Venezuelan, she never had any experience of racism. But I have seen cases of racism in the countryside and in the town.
Beth, what's your interpretation of those numbers?
I was just going to respond to Dominic. I think we need to sort of zoom out from the idea of just individual racist, individual bad eggs, and to consider it's almost like a social contract. We've had the negotiation and discussion about our presence in cities as people of colour, from Windrush, the riots, challenging the colour bar. We've had the public conversation and debate, but people of colour's presence in the countryside is still very new as a topic to discuss and to talk about. So there are a lot of people who have never given thought to these kind of issues, given thought to what it's like to encounter people who are different, and they respond to us like that when we're in the setting. So I think there is something about us perceived as being out of place, that it's not just about individual racist sort of name calling, it's about a general attitude and gaze which looks at us as not being of the countryside. And on the receiving end, it feels unwelcoming, and it makes us feel there's an anxiety about safety.
And what does that mean in practical terms? Just give me an example of how you have that conversation.
It is about building bridges and relationships, but you have to feel safe enough to be in those spaces before that can happen. But I think there are also opportunities with organisations like Dominic. Like he says, he doesn't feel defensive about the issue, but to be able to acknowledge that there are some of us in the countryside, but also he can have a conversation with his communities about their attitudes and behaviours towards people that don't look like them.
Dominic, how do you feel about the idea of having more conversations about this where you live? Or is it just something that you don't want to discuss?
It's one of these topics that horses for courses. I think the big problem that Beth's got, well, you're going to meet certain people and you've got to have a conversation with them in a certain way. So if you're talking with someone who's in their 70s, you have a different conversation than if you're, you know, one of the lads that I teach rugby to who's 14. It's a different ball game. Yeah, you've got to address the conversation differently. I'd say there are some trailblazers out in the countryside. One of the most popular guys around here who's black, Wilfred Emmanuel Jones. He's a British businessman, farmer. He founded the Black Farmer range of food products. And he's an absolute hero, brings down all kinds of kids and from cities, from ethnic minority youngsters. And you know, he's a really popular, inspiring character in these parts. There are black farmers around, Gurkha farmers, Indian farmers around. And I think that things are gradually changing. But having these conversations where you're coming across, and I'll just say it how it is, with this sort of, you know, critical race theory isn't going to work. If you're trying to thrust things onto rural people, it's not going to work. What you need is a median. So Countryside Alliance, they bring people down to fish. So ethnic minorities out of cities to fish, which is brilliant because you can sit there all day by the riverbank. I do it, you know, nearby in Bramford Speak. It's fantastic. You can teach people how to fly fish, and you've got something that you're dealing with who rather than what. That's so key. You don't need to be creating divisions. What you need to be doing is to be treating people like people, and you get on brilliantly doing that. There's a whole bunch of kids came down to play football. And there was nothing in common that the local kids had with them until they played football. And after that, they had a brilliant party. You need to have something that doesn't segregate, that doesn't create these barriers. And that's what's important. As I say, it's the who, not the what. And yeah.
What's interesting here, though, is that so Dominic, you're focusing on kind of like individual interactions and showcasing them as kind of examples of good things happening. But Beth, you're talking about things in a much kind of bigger scale, and you're saying actually we can't look at those individual things as proof of good things happening. Where is the middle ground?
I think it's both
there?
Because they're both conversations. So in the examples Dominic's just mentioned, it's allowing people to get to know each other and have conversation. But I think there's also a role for magazines and organisations like his, they could be leading the conversation more generally, that there's too much of a tendency to see the issue as a black inadequacy or something black people have to get over, rather than having a wider conversation also to look at the realness of the white gaze. What are these attitudes that black people are picking up, rather than this sort of denial that there is anything and that it's just sort of in our imaginations.
Just give me an example from your childhood that would help us understand this.
I mean, it was such an idyllic way to grow up on a small holding, rural Suffolk, but also quite surreal in that I was in the community but not of it. And it's not until I was an adult that I realised that. I think if you'd asked me as a child, you know, how do I find it, I'd have said, oh, it's great, it's fine. Sometimes you're surviving something or accepting something as normal that you don't realise until later on, actually, that wasn't normal. Mm. But it's experiences from having, you know, I love to cycle or to roam and go off through the fields, having a car full of young men yelling nigger at me, and you're remote, you're isolated, it's very frightening. Where's this going to go? What's going to happen? And I'm at home, I'm not visiting, this is my home. So you're wondering, you know, what could I, might I encounter? So there's that kind of racism. But then there's also, for me, the more insidious kind, where, for example, older women whose currency is manners, is etiquette, snubbing you or not extending the usual manners they would to others. So there's all sorts of ways that racism manifests. It's not just violence and name-calling, but it is that subtle drip-drip, sort of more mundane message of, I don't see you as one of us. I don't feel you belong.
I feel maybe before we talked about that, we should have warned people that maybe they would hear a racist phrase like that, like the one you used there. But you felt the need to use that to explain your lived experience. And so just your childhood and your experience, then how does that inform what you do with your organisation now? Join the dot between from your childhood to now.
Yes. I was gathering all sorts of skills and experiences that I just thought was childhood. And it wasn't until I moved into the city that I realised a lot of people hadn't had exposure to that kind of freedom in nature, that direct observation, direct relationship with the natural world. So I started Wild in the City to work with all urban residents to help bring back ancestral ways of seeing the natural world, of engaging the natural world. But it became very evident that not everyone wanted to work with me as a black female. And so the work became about working with people of colour because they were receptive to learning from another black woman. So alongside supporting people to step into the countryside to learn about the natural world, we also have the research element looking at what are the issues of the barriers, not just for people of colour, but also looking at the attitudes of the white institutions, white organisations we come across.
Dominic, if you saw, and this is a hypothetical question, but if you saw an act of racism happening on your patch, as it were, would you intervene?
I have. I have a black Ghanaian work colleague, and he came down to East Devon. We had a meal together. I'd been in the same restaurant 3 days previous, and the waitress and the guy who ran the restaurant were incredibly polite to me and my family, and with my colleague, absolute change of attitude. And I went up to them and I said, you know, this is absolutely outrageous, just because my colleague is black. I've seen the same thing happened with him in a town just outside of London. So, you know, I've seen that kind of racism, and it's appalling. And you have to have the guts to go and stand up to these people and say, you know, you're a numbskull, you know, wake up.
Right. If you want to join in the conversation, you can do so, as you can every week, using the hashtag BBC Antisocial on social media. And some people have been doing that already. And producer Ellie is here to share a sample of them.
Yeah, a few social media posts. One says, I have lived in the countryside for 52 years. The country town of Somerset, to be precise. No one asked the likes of me if the countryside is racist. Most ethnic minorities prefer to live in cities or where there are more amenities and more folk like them. Another post on social media says, lived in a rural area for many years. Natives may be racist, but I've never experienced. And we also got an email to the Antisocial email address. And part of that said, it isn't a personal attack to say that people experience racism. It's a comment on society and provides a direction to where we can improve as a society.
Okay. Beth, how do you feel that this conversation gets conducted in society? Because it does get quite heated quite quickly, I found, on social media.
Yeah, I think if you say you've experienced racism, then sometimes white people can take it personally that there's an accusation that you are racist somehow by default, rather than just listening to the fact that different people, as we walk through the world, have different experiences, we're received differently. And for a lot of people of colour, it is our experience that we sense a hostility or you know, direct overt racism. And why can't we sit and listen and learn rather than become defensive and sort of want to silence it or somehow invalidate it? It is our experience, and it's through conversation, through understanding the experience of the other, that we can start to shift attitudes rather than just denying that it's a thing.
Dominic, is anything Beth saying here convince you that actually you do need to look beyond just sort of the experiences you've had and the things that you've seen, that there is a bigger thing here rather than just the actual evidence you've seen with your own eyes?
I think on the one hand, Beth's organisation bringing people from ethnic minorities out to the countryside is brilliant. I find it a bit of a shame that they need a safe space and stick together, and that they're not able to mix with the locals. And I think that there could be better organisation there. In terms of there being this kind of thrust of pushing some non-rural agenda on rural people, number one, I wouldn't know how to do it, because rural people are incredibly private, almost tribal. They're indifferent. Any outsider, you know, even from the next village, walking into a pub might attract attention for a moment. I mean, if I stood in a Hawaiian shirt with flip-flops up in Dartmoor, people would stare at me for ages as well. People who are different get stared at, and that maybe needs to change. I don't know how one would go about doing that. But the problem is that when you start forcing affirmative action, so whether it might be diversity training or forcing people to think, it backfires. And unfortunately, you're going to end up with people just ripping down any progress you're going to make and blaming it on critical race theory, which people consider to be completely passé in the countryside. They've got absolutely no interest in it whatsoever. And, you know, the peak critical theory was a few years after Pete Corbyn, as far as they're concerned. They're very matter-of-fact people, tend to be very matter-of-fact people.
Okay.
And that's a real problem. Yep.
Beth?
Yeah, this idea of enforcing diversity training, I don't know of anyone that's coming from it at that angle. It's about conversation. It's about listening to each other and this sense of it being a non-rural agenda. I mean, I feel I'm rural. I spent my first 20 years growing in the countryside, and I know Dominic, after having children, has gone back to living in the countryside. I'd love to, but I would lose my sense of community and sense of belonging, and I don't want to feel the isolation I did as a young girl growing up, and I don't want my son to experience it. I don't feel I've got the same luxury and privilege. But I think my sentiment in my way of life is rural. That's my formative experience. And so I don't see it as something alien coming in. It's about let us all enjoy this space.
But what do you do about the fact that maybe if the recipients of the message feel that the message is being forced on them, irrespective of what you're trying to do or what your intentions are, if they feel something's being forced on them, then it's effectively being forced on them?
Yes, but as Dominic said, you know, people who are different get stared at. If we sort of we're talking about that level, then it might be being asked to look at their own racism. And yes, if what you're saying is they don't like it, then well, they're trying to not come to terms with it.
Right. Okay. Ryan, let's leave the countryside for a minute because we're going to head to the museum, which is the setting for another flare up in this debate. Because a couple of months ago, Cambridge University's Fitzwilliam Museum of Art and Antiquities overhauled its displays and added signage for visitors explaining that pictures of English landscapes could provoke what it described as the darker side of nationalism. Claudia Di Tosto is a researcher in modern British and European art history at the University of Warwick.
The painting that got more attention was Hampstead Heath by Constable, done in 1820, which is hung in a room along with Monet, Springtime, but also works by contemporary artists such as Veronica Ryan and David Hockney.
So, Claudia, you've got Constable's painting of Hampstead Heath open in front of you on your screen. Give me your sort of thumbnail analysis of that painting.
So what we see is, first of all, this rural landscape, and we see some people that are working on fixing what looks like a carriage. We also have some donkeys. And at the very, very, very far end, we can catch a glimpse of the city of London. And also the artist leaves much space to a very nice sky full of clouds. And there is this shadowy part at the very bottom of the painting, probably the shadow of the clouds above. And that's the first layer. Now, when we look at a painting, we could describe literally what we are seeing on canvas, no? And then we could analyze the work in relation to the biography of the artist. So we could say that Constable painted the scene from Hampstead Heath when he moved there, leaving behind the bustling of London because his wife was suffering from tuberculosis. But also we could analyze the work within the specific economic, political and historic context. And this is what is called social art history. And we see that the work has been produced at the height of the British Empire, a moment when the everyday life in Britain was enmeshed with colonial political and economic violence. And the British countryside was associated with that ruling class that was being benefited by the exploitation of the labor of enslaved people in the colonies.
So Fitzwilliam's been taking a social historic approach with these descriptions.
This is the kind of theoretical framework that the Fitzwilliam adopted, which does not mean to say, of course, that you cannot appreciate the Constable painting in all its beauty.
Just spell out for me then, what is the link between what's effectively a painting of a big park in North London and colonialism?
Let's look at this idea of the landscape, no? Landscape that, of course, is a symbol of British identity. So in 1994, there was this art historian and cultural theorist called W.J.T. Mitchell, who published this book called Landscape and Power. So analyzed the landscape as what he called a medium of cultural expression, meaning that a landscape is shaped by the symbolic meaning and values. And this relates back to what I was saying about the ruling class of the 19th century. And in the 90s, there is a whole array of cultural geographers who discussed the relation between the power of the landscape as a signifier of national identity, which is something particularly relevant for Britain. And if a group of people is excluded from these landscapes, then this group of people is also sort of excluded by the nation itself.
Why was that work in the 90s so influential?
Well, the buzzword of British culture at the time, again the 90s, was multiculturality. So it was clear that there was a true discussion around all this kind of ideas. So what does it mean national identity? What it even means to be British? So I would say that in the 90s there was a lot of interest around these topics. I think it is important to highlight that museums acknowledged this aspect only quite recently.
Oh, so basically you could have been discussing these things at conferences for decades, but they've only filtered through to the kind of the mainstream of going to a well-known museum kind of in the last couple of years.
I don't believe that in the 90s a national collection had adopted a kind of lens like this.
What's the sort of the next frontier then for providing more nuance and a broader interpretation for artworks?
So a name for an artist that has reflected a lot on her own discomfort in the British countryside is Ingrid Pollard. So she is associated with Autograph, which is the Association of Black Photographers and also a gallery in London. And since the 80s, she has produced works around the relationship between black people in rural landscapes. And for example, there is a work in the Tate Collection made in the 1989, which is called The Cost of the British Landscape, if I'm not mistaken. So in that case, the artist is looking at how landscape intersect with themes around race, identity, exclusion. She's kind of deconstructing a sort of code of Britishness that sees mainly white people walking freely in that space.
Thank you to Claudia De Tosto. Beth, I mean, how important is art and representation to this whole debate?
I think it's interesting. It wouldn't be our usual start point in framing the discussion, but I think it's very valid to consider that the parallels between sort of the green and pleasant land and how that has been, particularly in the environmental field, contrasted purity and pristine of land, but also of races, that the two have gone hand in hand.
Dominic?
Yeah, I didn't really understand much of what the art historian lady was saying. I think probably this whole story was concocted to be a sort of clever marketing ploy to get people to recognise there was this exhibition going on. And as a British taxpayer,
really,
you know, through the
Isn't this just a trend in museums? Isn't this just a trend in museums everywhere to provide a bit more info to people to process?
I think it may be so. I'm not against being reminded of European colonialism. I think art has its place. I'd agree with Beth, it's probably not an easy starting point to sell to the masses. But, you know, I think it's important that we're reminded of the horrors of European colonialism and, you know, being pro-colonialism is morally tantamount to Holocaust denial, in my personal opinion. I think that it's impossible to do cost-benefit analysis on colonialism. And if art's going to point us in a direction where we have that conversation, then great. I don't think that the fact that John Constable loved Hampstead Heath and painted a brilliant sketch of it has got much to do with all the other interpretations that the lady mentioned.
Beth, do you think the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge has done a good thing here?
I think it's very relevant to talk about it. I can't talk about Constable, but certainly know, for example, German National Socialism did deliberately depict that the rural countryside as an ideal, a safe space away from the race chaos of cities and Jews. So it is something that has been done. The use of art, whether it's landscape paintings or writing, being used to contrast pure and pristine landscapes, pure and pristine races.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, so I'm going to ask a huge question at a terrible time in the programme. But Beth, just we've mentioned a few times that the colonial background of the countryside. Just in a very simple way, explain how when you're looking out from the top of a hill across a landscape, you're seeing colonialism. I'm sorry to force you to do it very quickly.
It's not in the natural world. It's in the attitudes of the humans that you encounter and the gatekeeping of the institutions.
So it's not the landscape itself? Because sometimes
The landscape has been shaped by colonialism. So when you start to look at larger estates, when you look at who owns what, this plantation of trees is here because of, when you look at the lineage, then yes, absolutely, colonialism makes its mark on the landscape.
Dominic, is it valid to think about those things when you're at the top of the hill looking at the landscape?
I think that's the past. We cannot alter the past. I think we should appreciate its facts and move on, having learned lessons from the past into the future positively. And I think concentrate on the who, not the what. The divisions will evaporate.
Okay, as we're coming to the end of the programme then, Beth, what will you be doing in the countryside this weekend? I assume you're going to the countryside?
I am. I'm going to enjoy a lovely hike with about 20 so of our members through the North Downs, hoping for a few bluebells.
Okay, and Dominic, what does country life have in store for you this weekend?
Rugby training. So we're approaching a cup final, so it'll be getting very muddy up a hill in the middle of nowhere with a load of sheep and young lads shouting and playing lots of rugby.
And will any of this conversation be kind of on your mind as that's unfolding in front of you, Dominic?
Absolutely, yeah. I'll be looking across from the top of the hill down at the mansions and abbeys below and thinking of Beth's words. You know.
Are you saying that slightly sarcastically?
Not at all, no. I'd be very interested to talk to Beth and see how we can help to get more unity out there.
And Beth, when you're leading the hike in the North Downs, will you be thinking about this stuff, or are you actually just there enjoying the fresh air and hopefully the sunshine?
It's probably both, but yeah, just enjoying the awe and the bliss of being in nature.
Great, and that is where we will end the bliss of this episode of Antisocial. Thank you very much to our guests and to everyone who's been helping us understand this topic. We will be back with another topic next week. If you want to get in touch, use the hashtag BBCAntisocial online, or you can email us antisocial@bbc.co.uk. And of course, you can find our extensive and excellent back catalogue on BBC Sounds. Bye. Antisocial is presented by me, Adam Fleming. The production team was Simon Tulett, Ellie House, and Arlene Gregorius. The studio manager was Annie Gardner. The production coordinator is Brenda Brown. The editor is Richard Varden. Antisocial is a long-form audio production for BBC Radio 4.
Hi, this is Kirsty Young. I just wanted to let you know that Young Again, my podcast for BBC Radio 4, is back.
I'm telescoping two bits of the story together.
That's okay. It's only memory.
It's only show bits. We can say what we like.
In Young Again, we're joined by some of the world's most intriguing people.
Bill was the CEO at Microsoft at the time.
And I ask a simple question. If you knew then what you know now, what would you tell yourself?
Be very, very careful about the people you surround yourself with.
I gave too much power to people who didn't deserve it.
Subscribe to Young Again on BBC Sounds. I'm looking forward to your company.